Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. New from the author of the Wild Blue Press classics, The Trail of Ted Bundy and The Bundy Secrets, Ted Bundy's Murderous Mysteries is a deep dive into the archival record of America's most notorious serial killer. It's a veritable gold mine of information on Bundy, his victims, and this very voluminous case. Written by the foremost authority on Ted Bundy, this latest examination of his brutal serial killer contains new, revealing, and never-before-published interviews with those close to Bundy, close to his victims, and a potential victim who barely escaped his clutches. Ted Bundy's Murderous Mysteries brings to light for the first time many heretofore passed over facts about Bundy and reveals previously hidden aspects of the lives of some of his victims. The book that we're featuring this evening is Ted Bundy's Murderous Mysteries, The Many Victims of America's Most Infamous Serial Killer, with my special guest journalist and author, Kevin Sullivan. Welcome back to the program and thank you very much for this interview, Kevin Sullivan.
Hey, Dan, how you doing? Thank you so much for having me back. It's always good to come on your show.
It's always great to have you, especially when we're talking about Bundy and in light of all the hoopla and hysteria over Bundy, especially now. And we've seen fans of true crime have obviously seen you on some of the documentaries that have appeared recently. So you are, as we mentioned in the interview, the resident expert on Ted Bundy. Let's talk about the previous books that you have written. Could you please mention the fourth Ted Bundy book. So can you mention the previous three books, please?
Yes. Yes. Excuse me. My first book was called The Bundy Murders, A Comprehensive History. And I've said this often, I never had any intention about writing anything about Ted Bundy, but back in 2005, I met through a mutual friend, Jerry Thompson, and Jerry was the retired homicide investigator out of Salt Lake City, Utah. By the way, sad news out of Utah, Jerry passed away yesterday, and so that was sad to hear that. Yeah, but and Bob Hayward, the arresting officer of Ted Bundy, died a few months ago, and his wife died yesterday. So, yeah, but anyway, but I never had any intention of it, but a local friend of mine here in Louisville, Jim Massey, has known Jerry Thompson for years, and so I was invited to meet him and his wife when they came to Louisville so anyway, it was very interesting because I knew meeting Jerry was going to be a lot of fun. And I thought maybe I might write an article about my meeting with him. But he brought that murder kit that Bundy carried. And Jerry's had the kit in his possession for years. And he brought that to Louisville. And I was able to take that to my home, photograph it, do all that stuff. And it was just very interesting. And before Jerry left, he gave me, and he gave my friend Jim, one of the Glad trash bags that Bundy carried in his murder kit. What Bundy would use these trash bags for would be to put the victim's clothes in them, and because he always left them naked with only like maybe a beaded necklace if they were wearing that. But all the clothes would go into these bags, and he might dump that bag 100 miles down the road in some dumpster or a Goodwill or something like that. So having that in my house and being, given that bag, it just was so surreal. I started really diving into the life of Ted Bundy, and I decided I'm going to go ahead and write a book about him. So that book was The Bundy Murders, A Comprehensive History. It's coming up on its 10th year anniversary. It was released in August of 2009. And it's been a good seller, and it was the only book that I ever thought I would ever write about Bundy. But in 2015, I started learning of some people that were either passing away or having significant problems. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll revisit the case and do what is called a companion volume. And I did that. And in 2016, my second book on Bundy, the companion volume, was The Trail of Ted Bundy, Digging Up the Untold Stories. And that also contained, just like the first book, a lot of new information that had never been published before. And I forgot to mention that about the Bundy murders, but there was a number of new things about the murders that came out with my first book, The Bundy Murders, and a lot of new information in general about the case. Well, some really great things happened for the trail of Ted Bundy. A lot of interviews came in. People were contacting me. They're valid Bundy contacts. And so all that new information went into that book. In 2017, I followed it up with another book because people kept coming to me that I didn't know that were associated with the case in one way or another. And after I vetted them, then I had a bunch of more people to interview. And so in 2017, I released The Bundy Secrets. And The Bundy Secrets, Hidden Files on America's Worst Serial Killer, had to do with not just these interviews, but a republication of many of these interesting case files that I've used for research for years, along with commentary from me. This new book is just about the same, but I never repeat information in any of my books. It's always new.
Right.
I've done the same thing here with this new book, Ted Bundy's Murderous Mysteries, and it's another republication of very interesting parts of the records with commentary from me and another chapter of brand new interviews of people, most of whom have never been interviewed before. And I found something interesting that happened for this last book because I've got such a large case file, probably up to maybe 10,000 pages of things about Bundy, all from various aspects of the case. And I didn't realize this, but for this last book, I ran across several pages that were misfiled years ago and put in a stack that I kept but wasn't supposed to be used. And they contain some unbelievably good information about Bundy, and it being published for the first time. I would have used it in the Bundy murders, but I misfiled it. And so it's interesting. So that information is in there now. And the information that's in there about these missing pages has to do with an interview of a guy named Charles Shearer, who said that he and Bundy was over at his apartment, and it was Charles's wife and Bundy, and they were all drinking. And at some point, Bundy kind of blurted out that the police are looking for him, are looking for his car because of the abduction of three girls. And he came out and said he abducted three girls. And when Shearer asked him, he said, "What did you say to repeat that?" He refused to answer. And so that's astounding. And so that story is in the book. But yeah, this is the fourth book, and I can break it to everybody here. I think this is a good place to do it on your show. Every time I publish a book,
absolutely,
I take about a week. I take about a week, and I just bask in it, and I've gotten my complimentary copies from the publisher, and I might read it. I'll post about it on social media, and I'll really just kind of enjoy myself. And I'm just taking about a week's break. Well, I had a guy contact me the day after my book came out, and he asked me something about, "Have you ever considered about writing about Ted Bundy from like this other angle and doing a book?" And I said, "Well, no, but that does sound interesting." And I thought, I'm not going to be doing this. So I said, "Well, I'll lay it aside. And if I ever want to do something about it, I'll let you know. But I don't really think I'm interested, but it's a good idea." Well, over the next several days, I got to thinking about it. And I called my publisher, or I contacted my publisher, and they loved the idea. So I'm already deep into the fifth book about Bundy. I can't say the approach or the angle now, but it's really going to be good. And here I've written a fifth book. And from a guy, I never had any intention of writing any books about Ted Bundy. It's a little interesting, I guess you could say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And thanks for that announcement here so people know. Even more to look forward to for the voracious appetite of Bundy fans and people interested in Bundy, all things Bundy. Let's get to Murderous Mysteries here. You talk about people that are familiar with this case, the Linda Ann Healy, January 31st, 1974. Tell us what you found out from these files, these case files that you used and researched and did this book from, but also the witnesses and what they saw. And what is it about these files? It's very intimate, but tell us, give us the details of what you found about Linda Ann Healy.
Well, most people will never see the case files of any particular case. When you're writing narrative nonfiction, what you'll do, like for instance, when I wrote The Bundy Murders, I have a lot of information. I'm writing it in my own voice, and occasionally I'll stop and quote maybe a small passage from the record or what somebody said, but I'm really telling the story from my point of view because I've digested the material, and I'm giving it back out on the printed page. But I remember as I was researching and writing The Bundy Murders, I kept thinking, these case files are so fascinating because even though you can't reproduce case files in large numbers in narrative nonfiction, because in a case like that, if you did that, you'd have a lot of facts but no real cohesive story. So you can't really replicate them there. But you can have a book of case file material, and other writers have done it, you know, over the years. There's a book out there now with Jack the Ripper, and you've got all those court testimonies and stuff, and it's fascinating to read, and all these questions and answers and depositions are just interesting. So there's a place for that. So I remember as I was, you know, writing The Bundy Murders, I thought, man, this stuff is so fascinating. I know I'll never be able to do it, but wouldn't it be great if I could put together a book of just case files? And I thought, well, it's just never going to happen. But I'd like for people to be able to see what the detective saw. And this stuff was very classified then. And it was all for in-house use. And what they saw on a daily basis as information was added. So I think there's a place for that. So when I did the Bundy Secrets, and then this last book, Ted Bundy's Murderous Mysteries, it's that way. And I had commentary. So if you're looking back, like, for example, you read my books on the Linda Ann Healy, you're getting the full story. However, if you look, in fact, I've talked about Healy, not just in the Bundy Murders where the full story is, but I'll touch upon it in other books, but I won't repeat the information, but I'll bring out new information about that in my other books. Well, for those who are reading either the Bundy Secrets or this new book, they're able to see the case files directly from the detectives that they were using in-house. And within that, they would take statements from everybody involved. So in the case of Linda Ann Healy, you've got her three or four other housemates that came in and were interviewed by the detectives. And very often the statements of people are rather long. And so in these two books where I've done this, people can actually see word for word what these people were asked by the detectives and how they responded. And it's a fascinating look, not just into police work in general and how they obtained this information, but how the information flows out of the people who are reliving what has happened and trying to give it back in a proper order. So it's fascinating stuff. And like I say, you've got all these testimonies from the women that lived with Linda Ann Healy and you know, what occurred that night. So it's a very, very interesting thing to be able to see these case files and go over them.
What was in I know because we can't go over every single thing that's in this book, but what about Linda Ann Healy what little tidbit was, I think, stood out that you didn't write about before, and people, especially big fans of this, Ted Bundy, wouldn't know?
Well, now there's various aspects. If you look at what if you look at how I wrote, you could really go down a number of areas there. If you look at what I wrote in the Bundy murders, when you follow the story, you can see as you read through it, there's information there, and I'm telling it. However, if you very often, and I do this myself, when I'm reading a book, I'll think, oh, I wonder what else occurred beyond that. So I wouldn't know what to say with any one thing. If you're thinking about any one particular thing, I'd be happy to comment on it. But these reports are so voluminous that when you look at how I wrote it in the Bundy murders, you could say, oh, I wonder if anything else happened here. Did she comment on this? You know how questions pop up in people's minds. So if you've got something that you're thinking of in particular, I'll just go ahead and comment on it.
When you talk about these witnesses that came forward, what was the testimony? What did the police indicate from that testimony that people might be surprised about? From anything from the missing pillowcase to the bed made perfect.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. What I'm about to say is not unusual. And I cover this in my first book. But when the police came into the house that night, I mean, you have to understand, she disappeared in the early morning hours of February 1st. And it was the middle of the night. When the girls woke up the next morning, Linda's alarm was going off. She hadn't turned it off. They thought she was sleeping. It's not happening. They don't know what's happened to her. They leave. They're gone for the day. They're hoping she'll show up. They're at school. They all come home that night, and that's when the fear really starts to build. So you've got a very strange case. That particular night that they came back and Linda was still gone, Linda was supposed to be there preparing dinner for her boyfriend and her mother and father, and I think her brother was supposed to be there as well. But she's nowhere to be found. So the father and brother show up, the father calls the mom, Mrs. Healy, and says, well, don't come over because she's not here. And she says, have you called the police? And he said, no, but I think we'll wait a bit. You know, that's just the nature sometimes of parents. This dad is so concerned, but he's not wanting to jump the gun on the police, hoping for the best. And she said, no. And she gets off the phone from him, and she calls the cops. Well, here's the thing. The police come over, and it's a couple men. You know, they're not detectives, but they're patrol officers. They come in, and they do the usual thing, and they're getting the name of the missing person, information about the people, relatives' names, all that stuff. And they do look around. But they weren't sure whether foul play was involved in this or not. When the detective comes later that night, and I can't remember, I think it was around midnight, might have been maybe around 11 o'clock. He comes in there, and he goes in there right into the room, and he starts to do his work. And what they find in Linda's room is really a strange thing. The girls had already discovered that not only was the bed made, it was made in almost like a military fashion. And Linda never made her bed during the week because she had to get up so early to go to the radio station. She was a ski announcer at a local radio station in Seattle. Had to be there by like 6:30. So she didn't make her bed at all during the week. And when she did, it never looked like that. There was blood on the bed. There was blood on the pillowcase. And the pillowcase was removed. But there was blood there. Now, it wasn't blood spatter, as if she were beaten. And Bundy would say later that she was choked into unconsciousness. Even though she was asleep, she woke up. But he choked her into unconsciousness, and that created a nosebleed. And the blood that they found is consistent with that because it wasn't in a spatter pattern. Well, Bundy takes this thing off of her nightie, hangs it up in the closet, makes the bed. I don't know. They're not sure if he wraps her up in a blanket, but he either lays her on the floor or puts her in the chair. She's unconscious. She's bleeding from the nose. And he makes the bed, and he grabs a backpack and takes some clothes. Now, he may be setting up the scene to look like she went somewhere. So the police weren't quite sure whether or not this was a volitional leaving on her part or something that speaks of foul play. So it was really, you know, they just weren't sure. But when the police started to determine the real facts behind this, that Linda would not have left, and this happened over a number of days, that she would not have left the premises. Her parents were going to come over. She was doing fine the night before. There was nothing. This was so out of character. So this is one of the things I say about this abduction. It's a very surreal and strange abduction, and it's one that just one of the surreal type of abductions that Bundy would commit, the kind of things that you don't hear from, usually even from abductors. He just did these wild, outlandish types of abductions. So it was kind of a slow process for the cops to come to the conclusion that foul play was involved, and of course it was.
You write about another abduction, George Ann Hawkins, and you talk about an interview or a telephone interview with a person named Dwayne Covey. It's very interesting what you did learn from Dwayne Covey, and then again, putting together with everything else. Tell us a little bit about this abduction and murder and Dwayne Covey's role.
Yeah.
What do you have to say?
In fact, it's Dwayne Covey. I called him Covey for years until a lady that knew him said it was actually Covey. But it looks like it spelled like Covey. So I'm glad somebody finally told me it's Covey, but it looks like Covey. Anyway, I had contacted Dwayne because he was – what happened was on the night that George Ann disappeared, and here again – and, of course, I've been all over this area, and you can see how exactly it transpired. On 17th Street in the Seattle, near the school, they have just blocks from the school, a couple blocks. This is called Greek Row. Got fraternity and sorority houses. Well, the back alley is kids are going up and down that all hours of the night, and it's just a busy area. On the night that George Ann disappeared, she was well aware of women disappearing in the area. She was concerned about it. She was studying for a Spanish test. She broke away from her studies at some part during the early evening, and she and a friend walked a couple of blocks to a frat party just to relax a little bit, have a couple of beers, and just be with friends. As they came back, she wanted to stop in the fraternity house on the corner and go in the back door to see her boyfriend. But she said, I'm going to wait here, and I'm going to watch you walk down the alley. Because she believed in, you know, something called, you know, the buddy system, and just people need to watch out for each other. So she watched the girl getting ready to go in. They waved at each other and talked, and the girl went in. So she goes into her apartment, into the frat house, and spends, I don't know, maybe about 15, 20 minutes or so with her boyfriend, and she's coming out the back door. The back door, you know, makes that normal slamming noise or whatever, the screen door or whatever. And Dwayne Covey is right above there, his room, and his window was open, and I think he was studying. And Dwayne, he pokes his head out the window, and he sees George Ann, and they know each other. Well, unbeknownst to Dwayne or George Ann, Bundy is down the alley. He's been hunting that area for a while, not just the alley, but on the main street on 17th and crossing. And Bundy had put on a fake leg cast, and he was hobbling on crutches and carrying a briefcase. Well, when Bundy sees this conversation going on, he stands back. He's back, oh, I don't know, maybe 50 feet. Excuse me. And he's watching this, and it could even be a little bit farther than that, but he can see clearly this is a young woman speaking with somebody up who's poking her head out the window. And so Covey and, you know, Georgianne, they talk a minute, they just kind of shoot the breeze. She said she's going back home to study for her Spanish test. And then then they said goodbye, like in Spanish, and they were just, you know, just talking and having a nice time. And so Covey does the natural thing. He goes back to his desk or whatever he's doing in his room, and Georgianne is then walking away the short distance to her thing. Well, she encounters, you know, Bundy. And Bundy, you know, he was a nice-looking guy, dressed well, articulate, and he looked like he was someone in real need, hobbling on his crutches, trying to hold on to a briefcase. So what's the kind-hearted Georgianne supposed to do? He asked for help, and she agreed to it. And I say in my first book, The Bunny Murders, that if for some reason, if Duane would have come back to the window about, you know, like a minute later, he would have seen Georgianne cross below that window with this guy on crutches, but he wasn't there. And of course, Bundy took her straight down, and that's on the corner right there after they pass under Duane's window. And then they took a right, and then they went up to the 17th, turned left, walked down about a block or so, turned left into an unpaved parking lot that was rather dark, where his Volkswagen was parked. And then, of course, he had already placed the crowbar behind the, I call it the right rear tire. Some people think, I mean, if you're standing in the car, it's the driver's side. But no, I mean, I'm viewing it from the inside. It's the passenger side. As you're driving a car, the right is the passenger. Well, he put a crowbar between the passenger side, the right rear tire on the passenger side. As Georgianne is helping him, and Bundy would use this ruse with other people and try to get women to, like, take the stuff and, like, for instance, he might hand her the crutches and she'd put them in the car. While he's doing that, and he did this with Georgianne, he grabbed the crowbar and hit her. And he hit this woman with such force that she came out of one of her shoes and both her earrings, you know, flew off. But then once she was out into the car, she went. Well, you know, Georgianne, and of course, the next day he had to come back on a bicycle. And you see, if you watched any of the news, the film footage, there's a lot of film footage in that alley the very next day. It's a beautiful day, you know, blue skies, and the cops are there, and the news crews are there interviewing people. And at some point, Bundy is riding a bicycle through, and nobody's going to pay attention to him. And he doesn't stop there. He goes down to the block around, you know, about like a block and a half, turns in that alley, finds the earrings, finds the shoe, the clog, and off he goes. Well,
incredible.
Georgianne was a really sweet girl, well-liked, and it made such an impact, her death, on the people that know her. And you'll find this a lot of times with the friends of victims. They don't like talking about those things. And my original contact with Duane, I had sent him a letter. I had sent him a letter asking if we could talk. And he at first never responded to it. So I sent him a second communication a number of weeks after that. I said, listen, Duane, I said, I'm sure this bothers you. So, you know, we don't have to do the interview. I said, I did have just a couple quick questions. If you could possibly answer those for me, I just would appreciate it. And he told me later, he said, well, your letter was so nice. I just had a response. So he called me, and I was true to my word. I didn't go into a real detailed kind of interview. My questions were, I just wanted to confirm a couple of things. I told him this because Duane had been interviewed by a reporter from the Seattle Times about this. And I found that original article. I have it in my case file. There's a picture of him and her boyfriend, Georgianne's boyfriend, Marvin Galatly. And there's just, it was a big article. And I just asked him to if he could confirm that what he told them in the article was true, and he said it was true. And what happened was, and I have heard that, you know, people have different feelings on this. It might have been somebody else laughing. I don't think so. I think it was Bundy, because Bundy kind of alluded to what I'm about to tell you in a conversation with Stephen Michaud of The Only Living Witness and Conversations with a Killer. But anyway, as they stood there talking, they could hear laughing down the alley, occasional laughing. And they weren't talking long, but they heard it. And she turned and looked down the alley, and I think Dwayne did as well. But he had reported that in the newspaper. And so I asked him about that. He said, yes, she did. He might have said we did. But she definitely turned her head. I personally think that's Bundy. Other people have said it was probably somebody else. I don't think so. Because if you put in what happened there and what Bundy told Michaud in the third person of what might have happened that night, it just makes perfect sense. But Dwayne's a nice guy. But, to this day, he's affected by that. And the close friends of the victims usually are like family members. They just have a hard time with it, even all these years later. Excuse me.
Absolutely. Let's use this, Kevin, as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, ShipStation. When you're selling online, getting your orders out can be a real pain. Time-consuming, expensive, so many carriers to choose from. How do you know you're making the best choice? That's why you need ShipStation.com. It's the fastest, easiest, and the most affordable way to manage and ship your orders. ShipStation helps you get orders out quickly, save money on shipping costs, and save your customers and keep your customers happy. No matter what you're selling, Amazon, Etsy, your own website, ShipStation brings all your orders into one simple interface, making them really easy to manage from any device, even your cell phone. ShipStation works with all the major carriers, including USPS, FedEx, UPS, even Amazon Fulfillment, so you can compare and choose the best shipping solution for you and your customer. They even offer big discounts on shipping costs. Now, any business can access the same postage discounts that are usually reserved for large Fortune 500 companies. You'll always know that you're getting the best deal. No wonder ShipStation is the number one choice of online sellers. You'll ship more in less time with the best rates available. And right now, True Murder listeners can try ShipStation free for 60 days when you use promo code TRUEMURDER. There's absolutely no risk. You can start your free trial without even entering your credit card info. Just visit ShipStation.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in True Murder. That's ShipStation.com, then enter promo code True Murder. ShipStation.com. Make ship happen. Now, Kevin, let's move on to another particular case that you wrote about in this book, and that is, of course, it's been covered before, but there's more new, incredible information about Roberta Kathleen Parks, referred to as Kathy, and May 6, 1979 encounter. She was enrolled at Oregon State University at Corvallis in May 6, 1974. Tell us a little bit about what you found out about Kathy Parks. More new information.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll go back because it's so interesting that that's been a kind of gradual thing. When I was writing the Bundy murders, of course, I had all the files, and she disappeared May 6, 1974, around 11 o'clock. And Bundy, Kathy used to like to walk at night by herself, or she'd sometimes invite a friend, but most people turned her down. But she liked to walk, like, from her place at Second Hall to the Memorial Union Commons cafeteria. And that closed, I think, at 11, so she would go earlier. But she just liked to kind of walk to campus sometimes after it was dark. And she had been invited to go and to spend some time with some people at Second Hall, but she decided she wanted to go walking around. Well, she did. And on the way to this cafeteria, she ran into Lorraine Fargo, who had been in the library studying, and they talked a while at on the corner, just right across a little side street, right from the Memorial Union Commons. And they talked, and she, even Lorraine said, "Well, do you want to go?" Because Kathy was having a problem. You know, she loved her boyfriend, Christy McPhee, but he wanted to kind of go ahead and get married. She wasn't ready for that. So she was kind of explaining to Lorraine the problems that she was having. And anyway, she said, "Well, come back with me and we'll talk." She said, "No, I just kind of want to walk around for a while. I want to go into the, you know, the cafeteria." So they said goodbye. And that was it. Well, Bundy would later say that he, in the third person, he came up and talked to her in there and convinced her to go with him. Now, a couple interesting things occurred. When I was writing the Bundy murders, there was a letter that Christy had received after she disappeared. It was postmarked May 7th. And because this was late on May 6th, I thought, geez, I wonder if she had that letter with her or if she had married it earlier, had mailed it earlier that day, or could it have been with her that night? I didn't know. And because Bundy was hunting, I thought, I wonder if he had been hunting at the library and had even seen Lorraine. I just didn't know. So I kind of speculated on these things. Mm-hmm. And when after the Bundy murders was published, a year later, Lorraine Fargo got in touch with me, and she confirmed to me two things. One, yes, Kathy had a letter in her hand, and when I left her, she went right across the street and dropped it in the mailbox before walking up the steps at the Memorial Union Commons to go to the cafeteria. And then Lorraine told me, she said, "Yes, I was at the library, and I did have a man following me there, and he was very strange. And it really bothered her. She started to get very creeped out." And I think it's quite likely it was Bundy, because he loved hunting libraries. And so she left with a bunch of people, so he couldn't follow her. And that's when she ran into Lorraine. And I say in the Bundy murders, could he have been following Lorraine and then saw Kathy and made it? So this may very well have been how that unfolded. Well, in any event, when I wrote my second book, The Trail of Ted Bundy, I had Lorraine talk about that. She and I had conversed with over phone calls and email. And so I took a lot of what she wrote me about that was a confirmation, and I put it in that book. But for this book, I wanted to do something more. Outside of the mentioning of letters, because very often this will help people understand a victim even more, and just as a person, just to see them as real people and not just victims. For this book, there's a number of letters that were between Kathy and, you know, her boyfriend, Christy McPhee. And so I have those in the book, and I felt like it was important because I want to show as much as I can about, you know, the victims. And I have to say, and people have said this to me, that I broke new ground in the Bundy murders, my first book, by making a lot of these victims more real and having more in there about them. And that was my intention, and I was successful. And a lot of people have said, yes, that's exactly what you did, now I felt as I was reading the book. But for this book, because it's mostly about the victims and their testimony and the living victims and the things that changed them because of what happened, I wanted to put these letters in there. They're very personal, they're very honest, and they're very important to understanding the character of Kathy. And those who read the book, they'll also find in there a list of things that her parents had to pick up, you know, like something like 80 books or whatever, and various items she had. And you can see from, like, especially the books, the things that she was interested in, which helped paint a better picture of who she was as a person. What were those things that she enjoyed and liked reading about and liked learning about? And what were the things that fascinated her in life? So that's what I wanted to do, and that's why I have so many personal things about the victims that come from these case files, and I've added them to this book.
You talk about that personal element with her corresponding, but it led for the police to not have any idea. And, of course, as investigators, they had to pursue all these other leads and possibilities and certainly weren't considering Ted Bundy at that time or any other killer. So it's very fascinating to see all the work they did to look at the possibilities that she was so depressed or that she was so frustrated or she would do something to herself or run off. And so it's actually pretty disturbing to see how much they can go off on a detour when they're not seeing any of the facts that we now know to this day. So,
and in fact, Lorraine told me, and of course I have this in there, but and it's in the trail of Ted Bundy. She said, when the investigators were interviewing me, I told them everything that I could tell them about Kathy, but I withheld the fact that she was not just, he said, I admitted that she admitted to me that she was drinking too much, but he said, I withheld the fact that she was also using drugs. She had been smoking hashish and things like that because I didn't want to get her in trouble. And so, you know, there was these little things that came out that where they weren't quite as truthful as with the investigators. And that's why sometimes I end up being surprised if I'm able to interview those who knew her. And I had a number of people contact me after the publication of the Bundy murders who knew Kathy, who would tell me things. And, you know, and in every case, they were very much affected by what happened. But they would also tell things that maybe the investigators didn't know about the personality of the person. And that's a fascinating thing to look back, because what you're doing when you go into something like this, you're peeling back the layers of what a person really is. And I'm saying that in a positive sense, because we are all complex individuals as people. We all have our ups, our downs, our successes, failures, where we got to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps and go again. And it's so true, really, of young people and college people, because they're just beginning all this. And many people, as they stabilize as adults, things are going really much, much better in their lives. But a lot of things are just, you know, hard and iffy and kind of like it's the unknown for these college kids. And so it's a fascinating study into the human personality, and that's why I always like to bring out everything I can to make these people, again, not just victims, but real people that people like you and I can identify with.
Let's talk about Janice Ott and, if I mispronounce this, Lake Sammamish. And
Lake Sammamish. The first M is kind of almost silent. Lake Sammamish.
I knew I was going to butcher it. So
that's okay.
Now we talk about Bundy. You write about Bundy, as you do in many of these books, and of course Bundy is at different times in his life, and of course through this book we have all the various Bundys, where he's more disorganized, obviously disorganized once he's in Florida, and his appearance is different.
Yep.
But let's talk about this beach scenario and the witnesses that that clearly see Ted's behavior. And what, as you mentioned, it's very interesting, I think, when he talks to victims, he's got this cool mannerism, smooth talker, good-looking guy, in this case, very well-dressed. But when he approaches a victim, as you write in this, it's been known from the testimony that you have that once these people refuse or give him any kind of resistance, he knows that they are probably not an easy victim. He just says, okay. And so that, is, again, it gives them no cause to either remember or take note of his behavior. Let's talk about his behavior on the beach that day.
Sure. The Lake Sammamish murders were, again, a surreal abduction, two abductions, daylight abductions of two people from the same park, one in the morning, Janice Ott, around 10:30, 11, and then Denise Naslund around 4:20, 4:30 p.m. that day. I never expect to hear of anything more bizarre than that. And there was 40,000 people in the bar. Now, Bundy was pretty fresh that morning. He did have a cold. He had some things going on, but, you know, he knew how to pour on the charm. And you can see that as he, you know, tried to get these women to go with him. And there was one woman that went with him. She actually was waiting for her husband and her kids to get there. And she went with him to help him in the parking lot to unhitch the boat or something like that. And she gets there and there's no boat, there's no trailer. He said, oh, well, it's at my parents' house up in Issaquah. And she said, oh, well, I'm waiting for my husband and my kids to get here or whatever. I can't. He said, I'm sorry. And so they walked back together. He said, oh, I guess I should have told you. Very congenial, you know, just very nice. And at no time did he display anything that was could give anybody a sign of something is not quite right here. And, you know, and then, you know, as I say in the book, it's a numbers game. You know, people may tell you no, but somebody is going to say yes. And so when he comes up to Janice Ott, which she's at, you know, she's sitting there, she's putting on suntan lotion. She's brought some paperbacks there. You know, Janice was a probation and parole officer in Seattle. Her apartment had been robbed, and she decided to get out of the city. And so she lived in Issaquah. She lived in a small apartment in Issaquah, just about 5 miles from Lake Sammamish. And so she would commute every day to Seattle. She just wanted to get out of, like, the, quote, the big city life, I guess. But she had come there all by herself. She was just going to spend the day there. And there's really an immense crowd. And Bundy, this is something people don't know, or a lot of people don't. He came to the lake a week earlier, the previous Sunday, and he was either hunting, probably not likely, could have been. More than anything, I think he was doing a dry run for what was going to happen next week, and he wanted to get the feel of the place with you know, crowds there. And when he was there that day, he ran into some friends and stopped with them and had a beer. So he was seen by people he knew. Right. So that must have been on his mind. So when he comes to the lake the next week, you know, he's dressed in white shorts and a shirt, white shirt, you know, white tennis shoes, white socks. And in fact, if you or the audience had seen a picture that had surfaced about a year and a half ago from Marilyn Chino, a friend of Ted's and Liz's, where he's getting into his VW, that was taken the morning that he was leaving for Utah, and he had just had breakfast with Marilyn Chino, Liz, and her daughter, and he was leaving that day for Utah. What's interesting about the photograph, though, he's dressed in that photograph exactly like he was dressed on the day he was hunting at Lake Sammamish. But in any event, he comes to the lake. He's spotting people near Janice Ott. She's on the ground. There's a couple people around her who would hear the conversations. One was a 15-year-old girl named Sylvia Vallant. Her name today is Mexer. And I've seen Mexer's testimony on the documentary. She's on the same one I'm on. She is speaking now about that Ted actually came up to her. But if you look at her, and I'm not disputing that, that's what she's saying now. But in her testimony to King County detectives, and there are two reports from her, one taken soon after that and one taken in November, where there was a follow-up by Bob Keppel's people, she doesn't mention any of those conversations with Bundy. Maybe she had, I don't know. I can't answer for it. I'm just saying she's talking about that now. But in the original testimony, and I have the report in my book, she says Bundy kind of went past her and talked and started talking with Janice Ott. Well, Sylvia's 15-year-old kid, she overhears the conversation very well, and she remembers it. And I remember I said in the Bundy murders, I said, well, you know, this is interesting that a kid that young would be paying that much attention, and that's a very good thing. So behind Sylvia and behind Janice is a DEA agent by the name of Jerry Snyder, and he's got his big dog with him, and his wife's there with the kids, but they're a little bit closer down to the water. So Jerry has to stay back with the dog, so he's getting a good view of all this, as did some others. So there were more people that heard this conversation that happened with between, you know, Ott and Bundy. And, of course, Bundy was pouring on the charm. He introduced himself as Ted. She introduced herself as Jan. And so, you know, she gets up. They heard the conversation. She was going to help him with the boat. He said it's up at my parents' house at Issaquah. He wasn't going to make that mistake again, as he did a little while earlier with that other woman. She said, well, you got to promise me you'll introduce me to your parents and take me sailing. He said, sure. I mean, that's easy. She said, I got a bike. He said, it'll fit in my trunk. And off they go. And, of course, she enters this nightmarish world. And as far as Sylvia Vallant, if Bunny did talk to her, I don't know whether she's concerned to put that in a report. I don't think so. I don't know what happened. So if you see her on TV and she's saying that, and then if you read the reports and that's not included, I don't have any answer for that. But so you've got some additional testimony that is coming forth in a documentary, which I think is very interesting. So, but in any event, if you may see a discrepancy, but that may be. But you do have the official report from her in my book. And so is the report from Jerry Snyder. And so is the report from, like, a number of these women. And the main thing is, most of these people describe Ted to a T. Just, you know, that, you know, they would make little errors on maybe the color of his shirt or whatever. But little things, and humans do that. But it was clear that Bundy was going to use his real name that day, and as he poured on the charm. And I feel that perhaps the reason why he did that is because of the people that he ran into the week before. And with the lake being even more crowded that day, July 14th, 1974, and it, you know, I mean, 40,000 people there, if you've ever been there, it's a packed beach area. And he must have been concerned that if he ran into anybody, and, you know, let's say he had introduced himself as Charlie, and somebody came up, hey, Ted, how you doing? It would immediately raise suspicion if the woman said, hey, I thought you said your name was Charlie. So, you know, because he's already abducting women in Washington State, there's just one more day of doing that. And I think he tried to avoid any problems. So he was using his real name. But, yeah, it's fascinating stuff to go in there and read the testimony of these people, which, thank God, you know, the King County Archives is, you know, housed this stuff. And Washington State was very interested in preserving this case.
One of the more fascinating things in this incredibly fascinating book is the Don Patchen, the retired detective from Florida that you spoke to about the Chi Omega investigation, and he showed you the files. And there was some scribbled notes, you said, that were on the margins. This is incredibly fascinating when the recorder was shut off, and yet there were still notes about what Bundy had said. Tell us a little bit about this interview, and especially about what you write about and include about some of the things Bundy said, supposedly he thought off
the record. Yeah, this was very interesting. I remember when I first went to see Don Patchen. I wrote the book, The Bundy Murders, chronologically. So the last that I would write about would be the Florida murders and what transpired down there. So I met with Don Patchen at his home, and came into his home back in August of 2008. And his wife was so nice, and we sat down, and she had baked some chocolate chip cookies for us. And I remember Don, he reached down to the right, and he pulled this big plastic tub up off the floor, placed it on the table, and he began removing files. And there were all the, you know, copies of his personal notes and everything, and he gave me complete access to all that stuff. And he showed me the things that he had written down when Bundy had asked him to turn off the tape recorder. And Bundy had become very honest at this moment. You can tell by what Bundy said. And he talked about sometimes he feels like a vampire. He talked about seeing a girl once riding on a bike, and I'm not looking at that portion in the book right now, but he talked about, you know, I knew I had to have her. And he said that something along the lines, you don't understand the significance of Lee catching me. That was Officer Lee, the patrolman in Pensacola.
Yeah.
And, you know, but he said, but you don't understand, you know, the significance of that. But see, Bundy did, because he could see the handwriting on the wall, because Bundy was looking back to the similar arrest by Officer Hayward in Utah. And that's why he fought so hard to get away from Lee. But in turning, when Bundy said, if you'll turn your tape recorders off, like I want to talk to you just between us, he didn't realize that these detectives were going to scribble everything down. And that would later be entered into evidence as if it was on the tape recorder. The only difference was it's the testimony of the officers of what Bundy said. And in fact, they had some recording issues anyway with their tapes. And there was a part of those tapes, I think, were disallowed by Judge Cowart later anyway because of some problems. And Bundy's attorney said, no, I mean, there's too much areas where the detectives could play with things. And so certain aspects weren't allowed. But this conversation that Bundy had, where he was just talking to them, and he made another comment. He said, I'm not going to tell you, you know, modus operandi. He said the downer,
yeah.
He said, like the actual killing was like a downer, okay? Bundy was just, he was kind of coming clean on a number of things, and he thought he was doing it in a private conversation with these men, and that it would go no farther. Of course, the detectives did what they do, and entered it into evidence, and it was ultimately used against him. But you can't read those notes without seeing how honest Bundy was becoming at that moment. Even when he was edging on telling something, he was still opening up. It was very interesting.
Yeah, you write that he said things like, mentioned the girl on the bike, I just had to have her at any cost. And he said, I never hurt anybody
mm-hmm.
I knew. Like you say, he said,
that's true.
He said, fantasies equal problems. He says, it has mm-hmm. to do with fantasies. It has to do with voyeurism.
Mm-hmm. And that was
incredible.
True. Yeah, he did that because, you know, he was, the thing about Bundy, you know, as he, you know, he grew up with a fractured personality, but he was not a predator. But as the years rolled by, his mind took on predatory thoughts, and he wanted to, you know, most boys grow up with sexual fantasies, and it's just about having sex with women. The same thing happened to him when he was young, but he started mixing those fantasies with strange things like what the detective magazines showed on the covers of those things, binding women up, dominating women, threatening women. And he really started to get very twisted into thinking like that. And as he got even older than that, he was quite the peeping Tom. And he would go out at night, you know, he'd peer in on women, he'd stand there and masturbate in the dark. And, you know, when you're leading a life like this and you're already dealing with things where you have thoughts of abducting women and doing something, there is going to be a point where you pass, and I say this in the book, from fantasy to reality, and you cross that thing. Because the actions he took when he started crossing, he had lived with those for a long time. I even speak about how when he was admitted being back east back in 1969, how he was on the verge of abducting women, and even tried to do it with one of them, and it failed. And it wasn't because he wasn't aggressive enough. He was bubbling over with aggression. He just was not yet a skilled predator. So Bundy knew he had a lot of work to do in getting to the place where he could do this and be successful at it. And boy, he reached that point because it took a long time to catch this man.
Absolutely. Before I let you go, too, you include a very, again, along with all the fascinating stuff, but something I had not known before, you get to interview somebody named Dunn. And this person was a friend of Bundy. Tell us just a little bit about this correspondence or this interaction you have with him and his reluctance. Tell us a little bit about that.
Now, I believe you're talking about the fellow that – I believe this is the man that hedged his testimony. He was a friend of Bundy's, considered a good friend. And when he first was interviewed by Jerry Thompson, he was not very willing to participate. I mean, they couldn't force him to. He wasn't under arrest. But things had transpired with him. And you can tell this guy was really a nice guy because he came back later and he apologized to Jerry. And he was transitioning from one, at that moment, from one who believed Bundy to a person that was becoming somewhat suspicious and wondered. And I remember he said to Jerry, after he apologized for being that way, and that he wanted to talk to them and be more open. You can almost see the kind of frustration because I think he called Bundy his best friend. And he said, do you really think that he did this thing? And I think Jerry said to him, yes, I do. I'm absolutely convinced of it. And so here was a man done changing and being forced to change simply because his own mind was telling him that Bundy could be a lot more than what he had pretended to be. But this is not unusual for Bundy, and this is why it's so – in fact, I'm just going to say it. The reason why I think people are so fascinated in Bundy in this case is because the outward Bundy was nothing like the inward Bundy. The outward Bundy was very likable. And that's why when this first started to come out about Bundy, there were two places Bundy really put down roots: Washington State, where his home was, and in Utah. And in both places where he had put down roots, he had a lot of people that just couldn't bring themselves to believe that the guy they know could be involved in any of this stuff. And so Dunn was in this same place. Good friends. Had a lot of laughs with Bundy. And, almost would do anything for the guy. But yet, he was teachable inside. And as all these things started to transpire, that's why he came back to Jerry and apologized and said, do you really think it's possible that this could be? And you could see the confusion in him. But he's also an honest man, and he wants to do the right thing, and that's what's important.
Yeah. It's incredible, too. I mean, he must be thinking about this forever. Bundy was his best man at his wedding.
Yeah. Yes.
Incredible.
They were close friends.
Yeah. There's so much information that we didn't even get to speak to. I urge people to pick up this book, Ted Bundy's Murderous Mysteries, The Many Victims of America's Most Infamous Serial Killer, Kevin Sullivan. I want to thank you very much for this interview, Kevin. For those that might want to take a look at the other books from Wild Blue Press and one from McFarland, the other Bundy books, tell us about your Facebook page or your website, please.
Sure. I actually have a number of publishers, but if anybody wants to go to either my author page on Amazon, you can find all of my books there, no matter who the publisher is. And you can do the same thing at Wild Blue Press. They also carry books, even though they don't publish. I'm writing for them pretty exclusively now, a book last year came out from McFarlane called Through an Unlocked Door, but pretty exclusively. But they'll carry at Wild Blue Press on that page all the books that I've published, just like on Amazon, you know, you'll see them. And in addition, if you go over to Wild Blue Press and you look for me on their list of authors, I have a lot of crime blogs or whatever that are archived there, and so you can go back and read them if you've never had a chance to do so. So people can find me on Facebook, on Amazon, of course, and at Wild Blue Press.
Thanks very much. Thank you very much, Kevin. This has been a great pleasure. Ted Bundy's Murderous Mysteries. Thank you very much. Hope to speak to you again real soon.
Thanks, Dan. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. Good night.